Begin. Good evening. Okay, so let me begin by asking you a question. If you were to write a commentary on, let's say, a notable book that is worthy of commentary, say a work by James Joyce or William Shakespeare, what would you begin with in your commentary? What would be the first 10 pages of the commentary?
Acknowledging the librarian.
He's spoken like a true librarian. Acknowledging the librarian who helped with the research. No, I think that's an excellent point. A bibliography. Okay, that might come at the end, let's say.
The reason why you're doing it.
Okay, so the reason why you're writing the commentary. Doctor, do you want to add something to
that? It's historic as well as other contexts.
Okay, so some form of introduction,
right.
As Judy just said, perhaps as an introduction, part of what that would mean is explaining or justifying the enterprise. Let's say with a commentary on the Torah, for instance, so many commentaries have already been written. What are you now adding? What's your contribution? What makes your commentary unique? What are you doing in this commentary? Yes. The problem is, if you open up page 1 of Rashi's commentary on the Torah, all you find is commentary. You actually don't find an introduction. There is no programmatic statement. And it's actually a little problematic. Some of Rashi's contemporaries wrote introductions to either their entire commentary or to a particular book of the Torah and said, here's what I set out to do. This is my goal. This is my mission. When it comes to Rashi's commentary, we're starting out behind the eight ball because his commentary begins with no programmatic statement, with no mission statement at all. What we've been doing the past 4 weeks is trying to identify the goals behind Rashi's project. And as we've talked about at length, we've identified at least three goals. To explicate the text, to offer moral and ethical lessons to the readers, and perhaps, as we discussed at length last week, to offer explanations of the text that could rebut Christian or heretical interpretations of the Torah. So I want to backtrack and understand what we mean by that first valence, by that first thing we said, where, oh, clearly one of Rashi's goals is to explicate the text. Now, I've been getting away with that explanation, and no one has stopped me and said, Rabbi Lee, what do you mean by that? What does it mean to explicate the text? Of course he's explicating, everyone's doing that, but what's the unique contribution? On what level? Is it a literary interpretation? Is it a psychological explanation? Is it a mystical interpretation or a commentary of the text? So it's very nice to say it's a commentary, but what kind of commentary can we really say Rashi's commentary is? Now again, to put it in context, someone like Rashbam is very easy to pin down and say, what's Rashbam's mission? What is he doing? He says it explicitly on a number of occasions. I'm here to explain the pshat level reading of the text. That's what the Rashbam says. We could spend more time understanding precisely what that means, but at least we have a sense. Rashbam is interested in the plain sense, in the literal sense, in the pshat sense of the text, and 99% of the time, that's what Rashbam is doing. And when he doesn't do it, you can call him on it, and it's an interesting and provocative question to understand why there would be an aberration from his mission, but his mission is clear. What's Rashi's mission, again, with regard only to this question of how do you understand, how do you place into context, how do you identify or pinpoint what kind of commentary Rashi is providing to his readers? Any thoughts about this really very basic question?
One thing we can conclude is that Rashi was stepping aside and didn't want to put himself forward and say, these are my ideas. He was saying, look at the Torah, these are some of the things we can say about it, or these are the things I'm putting forward as explanations.
Okay, so I think that's an excellent point, which we've touched on briefly, which is to say that very often Rashi is putting himself aside, to use your words, Manny, and in a sense saying, I'm going to present you with explanations that are already in existence. As we talked about, sometimes Rashi will put his own spin on things. He'll consolidate, he'll moralize, he'll cut and paste, and that's very telling. But Rashi doesn't start from scratch more often than not. So I think that's an important observation. Other thoughts?
From. I think you put an emphasis on the language.
Language. Okay. Can you say more? I mean, is it a grammatical interpretation of the text? Is it a literary?
No, the grammar, I would say, was much involved.
Okay.
But in a linguistic, text, he put an emphasis on language, and yet there is a contradiction which I rose last time as far as grammar is concerned. And it's not that they make mistakes language-wise, but there is a conflict how it is written. And no one really, and he did not go furthermore to explain it.
Okay, so if he's not explaining some of the linguistic problems, what is he doing? Meaning, what is the... I mean, we can say that he's not a mystic. I don't think anyone in this room would answer the question by saying he's mystical. So, if we can say what he's not, can we say anything about what he is? Not to put you on the spot.
Well, maybe he puts a different interpretation on a word that is used in a different way, usually in the
Torah. Okay, so you're saying that Rashi is sensitive to...
Nuances
in the language, and maybe we could even say nuances in grammar or grammatical, linguistic questions of diction, word usage. So I think there is a linguistic element to Rashi's interpretation. I think that's absolutely true, and that's a piece of it. Other thoughts?
It was focused before brevity. He's a champion of. Amount of words possible, and I guess he probably thought he's going to wax poetic, he's not really going to print it too much, so...
Okay, so Emilio is making an excellent observation, which is that very often Rashi is a champion of brevity, and he's able to consolidate and condense much longer messages and consolidate them into bite-sized nuggets, sound bites, what have you. So you're really making an observation more about form than about substance, but the form of Rashi's commentary is intended to be quick, easy, take-home messages. I think that's an excellent point. John?
One goal is he wants to clarify the text, whatever means possible. It doesn't have to always be or way. And sometimes you'll find a negative, and sometimes you'll explain literally or putting it in the proper sequence or whatever it takes to make the sense, to make the text make sense.
Okay, did everyone hear Joe's answer? I think that is an excellent point, and I want to use this as a jumping off point for the discussion that I want to share with you tonight. What Joe said is that there may not be a uniform methodology to Rashi's approach, and the way Joe formulated it, Rashi's, let's say, main goal, not to put words in your mouth, is to clarify the text, and he's not boxed in. Sometimes he'll clarify the text by pulling from a medrash. Sometimes he'll clarify the text by explaining some grammatical rule that may not be widely known. Sometimes he'll do some other trick to help us understand the text. So I think that's an excellent place to start, which is to say, maybe you could challenge the very assumption of my question. Who said, right, that these categories even existed, right, in the 11th century, or for that matter, in the minds of Rashi? Right, we in the 21st century, so you could go to Barnes & Noble and you could find 25 different sections. There's a psychology section and a self-help section and a history section and a literature section and a science section. So we have these categories. Did Rashi's mind operate in that way? I think the short answer to that question is no. What I want to do is use, if we can, the words and the terms and the categories that were available to Rashi and kind of transplant ourselves back into Rashi's milieu and into Rashi's mind, if we can, to understand the categories that he was using, the categories that were accessible to him, And then, within those categories, understand where Rashi fits in. And the two most important terms for this conversation are going to be pshat and drash. Okay. Those are the terms, those are the worlds in which Rashi was really operating. Now, jump with me, if you will, to the first couple sources on the sheet. What I want to do with you is tease out. It's true that Rashi makes no programmatic statement at the beginning of his commentary, but at least 3 points over the course of his commentary in all of Tanakh, we can excerpt lines which give us a sense of something more than the immediate explanation or something more than the immediate context, where Rashi is really showing his hand, where Rashi is really telling us sort of, I'm telling you this explanation because my mission is to, and he sort of tips his hand and lets us know something much wider about the scope of his project than just the narrower coming. We started off, we ended off last week by looking at what appears as source number one on your sheet. Let's review it quickly and then we'll move forward. This is a pasuk from the third chapter of Bereishis. The Torah says, "Vayishmu et kol Hashem Elokim yisalich began leruach hayom. V'yiskabe adam v'yishto b'nei Hashem Elokim b'soch eitz hagan." The long and the short of it is, Adam and Chava heard the voice of Hashem in the garden and they were very frightened. The problem is, what's the problem in the text? Can you identify, there's a funny word in the text, the funny verb. Vayishmu es kol Hashem Elokim?
Mitaleh.
And how would you translate mitaleh? Yeah, walking from the word halach. And mitaleh, what form is that? That's the reflexive, right? The hitpael. So if you really want to translate it, what would it be? Yeah, causing itself to go, right? So what's the problem? How would you just summarize the problem in a one word or one sentence question?
Well, how is God walking? I mean, he is not made up.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself. The question is, right, how is it possible, right, how is it possible that that the voice of God is walking, right? The voice of God is not a tangible thing that has two legs that could possibly walk. So what does the pasuk possibly mean when it says that the voice of Hashem is walking? It's peculiar, right? So at the very least, you have to understand what the verse is telling you. Begs the question. Along comes our friend Rashi to help explicate the verse. Rashi in source number two.
Can't the word mean just to go? It doesn't mean walking.
It could go, but it's still a funny meaning. Again, using the kind of rule of entropy and something like that. There's a word in physics for the least possible.
Well, entropy is when a system breaks down.
So that's not the word I'm thinking of, but it's the conservation of words.
Conservation of energy.
Conservation of energy. So in the Torah we say the conservation of word rule, which is to say, why would the pasuk have to? What is it called?
Occam's razor.
Occam's razor?
Yeah.
Is that what language is that?
Medieval
church jargon.
Occam's razor was that you take the simplest.
Oh, I see.
Whichever is the simplest.
The simplest explanation and the simplest. Right. We'll say the simplest formulation. Right. So if I were writing this pasuk, I would say Vayishmu es kol Hashem Elokim began. They heard the voice of Hashem in the garden. I communicated the message. I don't need to say that I heard the voice going or walking, whatever that word. So however you want to translate the word, it's extraneous. So what do you do with the word? Rashi source number two, Vayishmu, what does that mean that they heard the voice? Now this is fascinating. And again, we're less interested here in the exact meaning of the verse, and we're much more interested in Rashi tipping his hand and letting us know about his programmatic mission. Yesh midrashei agada rabim. Kvar sidrum rabbeinu al mechonam bebereishis rabba. He says, uvishar midrashos. He says, you know what? There are many, many homiletical, midrashic explanations of this verse. They're recorded in a collection called Midrash Rabbah, If you want to look it up, you could look it up. Okay? And incidentally, in source number 3, just to give you a taste, this is the Medrash that Rashi's not citing. Okay? This is the Medrash that he's referring to. You can just have a look with me, just for interest's sake, for a moment, parenthetically, in source number 3. Vayishmu es kol Hashem Elokim Eselech began l'ruach hayom. What does that mean? Amar Rabbi Chalfon, Shamanu Shiesh Hiluch l'kol. Has anyone ever heard of a voice walking? Shnemar Vayishmu es kol Hashem Elokim Eselech began v'hiluch l'esh. So what does it mean? It means that there was some kind of fire. Shneamar batalech esh arza, because the fire, it says, came down or went down. So we know that the verb halach is sometimes associated with fire. So there must be some fire in the garden, etc. And it's walking around. It's moving. It's the image that the Medrash is creating here based on this this pasuk. The Medrash goes on at length. If you're interested, you could look at it now or later. But Rashi says, I'm not interested in providing you with that midrashic explanation. Now, the underline, the most important part. Vani says, Lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra, ula agada hamiyasheves divri hamikra, davar divur al ofnav. This is the closest thing in the Torah we have to a programmatic statement by Rashi. So what's my mission? What am I coming to do? Vani lo bati, I'm only coming to give you pshuto shel mikra, the simple, let's say, pshuto shel mikra. It's a hard clause to translate, but let's say for simplicity's sake right now, I'm coming to give you the simple or plain sense of the verse. Hamiyasheves divrei hamikra, and this is sometimes a part of the explanation that we leave off, but this really comes back to a part that that Joe mentioned earlier. I'm coming to help make the text understandable. I'm coming to help put things into an order where they fit. Right? That is my goal. To make the text work. To make the text fit as it stands. Okay? Umashma'o. And now Rashi, so let me do it for you. The actual meaning of the verse, here I am. I just gave you my mission statement. Now let me actually implement the mission and not resort to a midrashic homiletic explanation. Let me give you a pshat explanation. You know what the pshat is? What is it? Shamu es kol HaKadosh Baruch Hu shahaya mitalech began. It's a very subtle explanation. Anyone pick it up? What is Rashi saying about the verse or the word mitalech? That God was walking. He says, you misinterpreted the verse. It's not that they heard the voice of Hashem walking. It's a little ambiguous, he's saying. The pasuk is telling you, right, there are two possible subjects that could be qualified by the word walking. Is it God who's walking or the voice? Everyone thinks, because of the juxtaposition of the words in the pasuk, that it's the voice. Right, the voice is walking. That seems to be the subject. In fact, Rashi says, it's not true. It's the voice of Hashem that's walking. The one who's walking is Hashem. So Hashem is in the garden. Of course he's in the garden. That's known to us. We can talk about what that means later on. But Hashem is in the garden and his voice is being heard. Everything now fits.
And yes, God wanted to make sure those who are in the far distance will hear his voice. So he went, he was walking,
okay,
to make sure that everyone heard his voice.
Okay, right. I think that's a very viable explanation. Hang on one second before we come to your question. But the point is, there was nothing earth-shattering about this explanation of Rashi. There was nothing moral, ethical. There was no ethical meaning. He wasn't rebutting the Christian polemicist. All he did was, in a very short, concise, subtle way, all he did was make the words fit into the simple meaning of the pasuk. He answered the question. Right? He gave you a means by which to read the verse where everything fits. Emilia?
I was just going to comment if I could find a Kodesh in this room.
This section.
There's so many.
I don't know where the trough falls whether it tells you.
That's an interesting point. I don't actually remember about the cantillation marks. Sometimes they help indicate how the verse should be broken up. That's an interesting observation. But does this make sense? Meaning, this I think is crucial to understanding part of Rashi's mission, which is to say, it's not always going to be earth-shattering. Sometimes he just wants to help you read the text in its most straightforward way.
How does
does have such a quiet thought. I want to see what he achieved.
Well, what he achieved is, in case, right, maybe you were so smart that the question never occurred to you in the first place, but if the question did occur to you, he now gave you a means by which the question falls by the wayside. The word mitalech, you think, is talking about a voice, and how could a voice be walking? It says, no, that's not the actual meaning of the text. The one who's walking is Hashem, and now it's possible to read the pasuk in a very straightforward, simple manner where no questions jump off the page and sort of arrest the progress of the text.
It's easier to conceive that God is walking rather than the voice of walking.
Exactly. Exactly.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is Rashi also giving us a guide to his commentary on the Gemara?
So that's a good question. The short answer is no. Rashi's commentary on the Gemara is really doing something very different, and perhaps we'll come to that later on in the course. But right now, we're really restricting our analysis to the commentary of Rashi on the Torah. Other questions? Esther?
As a 21st century reader, though, I'm much happier with the voice walking than
that is a that's a funny point, meaning I think it's a good point, which is to say sometimes things are better left unsaid, meaning sometimes, based on our contemporary sensibilities, a particular explanation will resonate more or less, and that's the nature of an evolving human mind, and sometimes we'll find commentaries that seem outmoded, outdated, etc., and that's perfectly natural. And again, that's why I sort of prefaced our conversation by saying if we could transplant ourselves to Rashi's, 11th century, this would be the, and pretending that we're his audience, it just so happens that Rashi's commentary is so great that it actually manages still, 1,000 years later, to speak to us, but the number one audience, of course, that Rashi's addressing is his readership in 11th century France. Avi?
I'm sort of agreeing with what Esther says. Wouldn't Rashi's explanation make more sense if the Pasuk read, V'ha'elokim ha'lech agan, v'yishmu'u et kolo?
Yes, so that's interesting. Without getting too far afield, biblical grammar is restricted by some very rigid formulas, which is to say, for instance, that the verb has to come before the object. So there's almost no other way to accomplish this other than to write it in this particular word order. Again, without getting too complicated, there's almost no other way to do it. Men?
Rashi makes such a point about running away from the Medrash and sticking to the Pshat.
Yeah.
That there's something in the Medrash that he's afraid of. And what he's afraid of is that the Medrash is talking about original sin and saying that before they sinned, the Shekhinah was walking with God, and after they sinned, the Shekhinah went out to the higher area. So he wants to stay away from it.
So I think that's a great observation, and I think part of what's so important about your observation is that, and this is a good segue into the next thing which we're going to talk about, or the next source we're going to see, which is, if Rashi doesn't cite a Medrash, should you be asking, why not? Right? So, but the first point is certainly to observe to observe that reality, which is, there's no Medrash here. Okay, so I want to come back to that. If we stopped, Joe, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, the word that's left is still strange. So I should explain that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Meaning, you're right. The word mitalef is extraneous, and Rashi seems to actually not be bothered by that question, but more by the question of how is it possible for the word to be qualifying a voice. But naniach, it's a given that the word is okay in the text. You could ask the second question, which Rashi doesn't ask, which we brought up, which is the word is extraneous, and he's not addressing that question. That is a fair observation. Okay.
So do we know why sometimes?
So that's a harder question, and maybe we'll touch on that. That's a very hard question. Joe's saying, without getting too far afield, very often Rashi is answering unstated questions. So how does Rashi choose which unstated questions to answer? There's so many questions that you could ask on every pasuk. Is there a methodology? Is there a means by which to know what questions Rashi is more likely to be responding to. We're going to touch on that, even though that's a very difficult question. Okay. Now, if we just stopped right here and said, this is Rashi's mission statement, this is Rashi's programmatic statement, this is what Rashi's interested in, Pshutel Shel Mikra, then you'd have to wonder every time Rashi violated that, and that must be half the time, and cited a medrash, what happened to his, right? I mean, pin him to the statement. This is happening, it's actually, I exaggerated a little and said there's no mission statement at the beginning of Bereishis. This is not so deep into his commentary. This is the third chapter of Bereishis, and already he comes and tells you a kind of clear mission. Vani lo bati el pshuto shel mikra. You can't really get clear in that. My sole purpose, Rashi says, is to give you the pshat of the text. So I want to consider source number 4 for a moment. There's something fascinating that happens when we come to the book of Shir HaShirim. We come to the book of Shir HaShirim, we really hit the jackpot because Rashi gives us an introduction. Wow. Rashi's going to tell us what's going to happen in the commentary to this book of the Torah. I mean, you can't do better than that. Now we really have Rashi giving us the programmatic statement. So here it is. This must be a real gold mine. So let's have a look. Source number 4, Rashi's introduction to Shir HaShirim. Achas davar elokim shtayim zu shamati. Okay, so he says poetically, Hashem said one thing, I heard two things. Wow, what does that mean? Mikra echad yotze l'kame ta'amim. You know, from one pasuk, Rashi says, can come several explanations. Wow. That's already revolutionary. The end of the day, he says, you can't deny that the text also has to be read as on a pshat level. Okay. Umashma the apal pi shadabru anavim divrayim bedugma tzrich liyashev hadugma alof neha be'al sidra kemo shemikraot sederim zeachar zeh. He says, and even though the prophet sometimes spoke using examples and using metaphors, you still have a responsibility to make the text fit. Right? Things have to appear in context, and they have to make sense, and you can't have non sequiturs. They have to proceed along a particular order. He says, you know what? In looking at the text of Shir HaShirim, at the book of the Song of Songs, I've noticed that there are many, many midrashim written about this particular text. And you know what? Yesh sodrim kol ha-sefer hazeh b'midrash echad. Yesh mefuzarim b'kama midrashei agada mikraos levadam b'einam misyashim alashon ha-mikra v'seder ha-mikraos. And they're all over the place. They're midrashim about the whole text, they're midrashim about individual pieces, and they're scattered, and they're piecemeal, and it's just a mess. He says, you know what I'm going to do? V'amarti b'libi, so I said to myself, V'amarti b'libi, litzfos mashma'ut ha-mikra liyashev bi'arim al-sidram, v'ha-midrashos mi'arvaseinu ekavam midrash midrash ish ish bimkoma. So now what does he say? What's his mission? What's he going to do? I'm going to find the mashma'ut ha-mikra. What does that mean?
Essence.
The meaning, the essence of the text, right? Again, and this we're going to come back to in a minute. Not necessarily the pshuto shel mikra, not necessarily the pshat level, but the real, I like that word, actually, the essence of the text, the real meaning of the text. And how am I going to do it? By taking the midrashim, by taking all the midrashic explanations and organizing them in to a coherent whole.
Instead of one by one.
One by one. I'm going to take it verse by verse, medrash by medrash, and organize it such that there's a cohesive meaning to the entire book. Now, Shir HaShirim is wild. And Shir HaShirim is all this love poetry about a lover and his beloved. They're going back and forth, and you have pastoral imagery and city imagery. It's a mess, right? Some commentators, contemporary or more modern commentators, even suggest that, right, there had to have been multiple authors to Shir HaShirim because it's such a patchwork of different poems. So Rashi says, I'm gonna solve the problem for you. I'm going to take all the midrashim and connect them such that the story reads as one fluid, coherent narrative. And it's amazing because Rashi manages to do it. Every verse is explained based on the Medrash. Every verse is explained homiletically. The entire book is read as a metaphor of the love between God and the Jewish people. Right? That's the lover and his beloved. And, I mean, it's an amazing piece of analysis, interpretation, commentary, to take all the... there's nothing mechudash. Rashi doesn't invent anything. All he does is select from this vast library of midrashic literature the various components of the pieces of the narrative that seem to fit into a cohesive whole, and then he strings them together and makes one cohesive narrative. It's a stunning and amazing project. Rashi manages to pull off right what no one up until his time had ever been able to do. That being said, what does Rashi say is the most important point? What does Rashi say his goal is? Does he ever use the word Pshuto Shel Mikra? No. It's not about the pshat, it's about the mashmaut, right? And it's about the essence, and how's he going to get there? He's going to take all the midrashim, right? He's not, there's not one pasuk, right, which he's going to read literally. The Art Scroll Chumash, actually, the Art Scroll Tanakh, rather, was printed and then reprinted more recently. The original printing of the Art Scroll Tanakh, Shir HaShirim is translated not as a translation at all. I mean, it's almost funny to read it, because you'll read the pasuk in Hebrew and the words will have nothing to do with the literal explanation of the verse you just read in Hebrew, because what Art Scroll did was take a summation of Rashi's commentary. Right? So it's all based on midrashic literature, which is based right on the text itself, but it all comes from the Medrash. So you'll notice right that entire commentary, it's actually a useful piece. When Art Scroll reprinted it, they reprinted a more literal interpretation. But if you have just that original Art Scroll piece of Rashi's commentary, it's entirely midrashic. It's amazing. Rashi just told you 2 minutes ago in his introduction, in source number 2, that the main thing he's interested in is pshat. And now, in his introduction to Shir HaShirim, he tells you, you know what I'm really interested in? Is using midrashim to explicate the text. So, which is it? Is Rashi really interested in Pshuto Shel Mikra? He just wants to tell you the simplest, most basic shot level of the text? Or is he really interested in calling upon this vast corpus of midrashic literature to explain the text midrashically, homiletically? You know?
I would say the fact that he feels that he needs an akdama for Shir HaShirim denotes the idea of an exception. That I'm going to make an exception for Shir HaShirim. That normally, maybe Mashmaut is really what he's after, but Mashmaut in this case would require me to take a look at all these midrashic sources and compile them and organize them. But that's not necessarily so in everything else, because otherwise he would have said that Dhamma would be gracious, not to.
Okay, so that is a great point. And the scholars are actually torn about whether or not this introduction to Shir HaShirim and what he says about his emphasis on Medrash can really be transposed onto the rest of Rashi's commentary, or as Emilio was suggesting, maybe this is the aberration. Really his main project is Pshuto Shel Mikra, where that breaks down and there's no way to really make everything work with Pshuto Shel Mikra, we'll take an alternative approach and resort to Medrash. Okay. I think that's possible. I want to examine with you one more set of sources. Yes, man.
Back to the thing we were saying before, that what was bothering Rashi. So here, what is this love story doing
Tifriyat regarding Rashi.
Right.
So he's saying, well, this is really a call to Israel to come back from the Galut and to go back to Israel and the relationship with God. So you see that that's what he means by Mashmaot. What's it doing here? It must have a meaning. That's not true.
Okay, I think that's an excellent point. I happen to agree with you, and I happen to agree with Emilio. My own personal sense, and we could debate this, and we'll have more information to use to get into this debate. My own personal sense is that mashma'ut is really the key. Right? It's less about the dialectic between pshat or drash. Is Rashi really interested in pshat? In which case, why is he bringing medrash? Is he really interested in medrash? In which case, why is he bringing pshat? I think Rashi is really summing it up in this line, V'amarti l'libili tfos mashma'ut ha-mikra. I want to find the mashma'ut ha-mikra. I want to tell you the real essence, the real meaning of the text. Sometimes the way to get there is by telling you the pshat. Sometimes the way to get there is by telling you the drash. And sometimes it might even be a combination. Look at source number 5 for a moment. Emilia.
It's a question because of the note. He didn't have a word processor where he could go 10 years later, go and edit the word that he was looking for. Could it be that he began with a concept of shock and drash, that's all he had in his mind? Sometime by the time he got many of his shir, he distilled it down to really not shot at once, it's mashmaut, and by that it was printed all over the place.
Right. So that's a great question. The question is there an evolution in the process of Rashi's own commentary? Was he interested in one thing toward the beginning of his commentary, and then it sort of evolved gradually and became something else?
Did Rashi really write in order, starting with the break from...
Right. So I don't think we know in which order Rashi's commentaries were written. But just to answer your question very briefly, the Rashbam, and I think we looked at this source in one of our earlier classes, the Rashbam actually says... I'm sorry, I don't have the text in front of me. The Rashbam says, you know, later in life, Rashbam was Rashi's grandkid, and Rashi died probably when Rashbam was around 20. Right? So, as a teenager and as a kind of young adult, Rashbam had already begun to work on his pshat commentary, and he writes that at the end of his life, he says, "My Zaidi, my grandfather, right, used to learn with us in the Beis Medrash, and he said if he could have rewritten his commentary, he would have sided more with the pshat people like the Rashbam." Now, at the Rashbam speaking, so you know, the great champion of the real pshat school, so it's a little hard to know how seriously to take him or whether that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think you raise a very interesting question.
But you can't compare Shir HaShirim to the other books, you know. Hapshat for the other books is, you can find the pshat, but you cannot really pshat in the Shir HaShirim, because you have to use a lot of the imagination to...
Okay, so I think that's an excellent point, and we could talk more about this. Meaning, there are different moments in the... Yes, absolutely. Meaning, there are lyrical elements to Tanakh, and there are more legal elements to Tanakh, and maybe each one has to be interpreted according to its own context.
And Shirin is a category by itself.
Right, that's very possible. That is very possible, and there's one side of the contemporary debate on this text, which says, yes, exactly as you're saying, this is not a line that can be transposed onto any other element of Rashi's commentary. Shir HaShirim is an aberration; it's unlike any other book in Tanakh. What Rashi was doing here is totally separate from the rest of his projects in Achanan. Joseph.
Same time that you could say that, can't you take the other side and say that this is perhaps the most blatant example, but maybe not, of something that you can read the same words and they mean two entirely different things. You take it as a beautiful love story, and that's wonderful. You take it as something else, that's also very valid. One doesn't necessarily diminish the other.
Right. So that's a really interesting point. It's funny though, because almost really more than any other time in Tanakh, Rashi doesn't give you the pshat. He doesn't tell you, "Oh, this is the pshat and this is the drash." He just gives you the drash. So it's very peculiar in that sense. He seems to be erring on the side of, you can't really read it as a pshat. I have to give you the medrash because that's the only way to read it. So let's have a look at source number 5 for a moment, because this will touch on a couple of the points that were just raised. Okay, so these are psukim which are coming up in the coming coming weeks of the parsha, which we'll see soon. 33rd chapter of Bereishis. Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. This is after Yaakov had battled Laban and Esav, and now he finally makes it back to Shechem. Sheva Eretz Kanan Bevo Mikatan Aram Yachon Es Pnei Ayir. Okay, he makes it back to Israel. At the bottom of page number 1, the second line of source number 5. Okay, he makes the purchase of the land, pitches his tent. Verse number 20, and he erects a mizbeach, and he calls him it El Elokei Yisrael. Okay, there's a little ambiguity there. Who's calling who? What? Okay, I mean, what do you think before you even see an answer? Vayikra lo, El Elokei Yisrael. So what are the possible interpretations of Vayikra lo?
Name.
He named it. Okay, Vayikra lo usually means him. Okay.
It's not names, those are titles.
Titles. So just to be clear, I mean, who's talking? Who's Vayikra lo? He is an unreferenced pronoun. Vayikralo. He, who's the he?
Yaakov.
What did he do? He called or named what?
He
called the Mizbeah. Right? I think that's the... Any other possible interpretations?
No.
He called Hashem's name. Okay, so two ways to read the pasuk. What does it mean? Did he name the Mizbeach? Maybe he went over and said, this is El Elokei Yisrael. I mean, that would be a funny thing to say. Or, he built the Mizbeach and he called out Hashem. Something like that. Turn the page for a moment. Source number 6.
It must be looking up that God called to him.
Ah, okay. Or God called to him. Right? Again, it was unreferenced. We don't know who called who. So hang on to that. That's a very good thought. Source number 6, top of page 2. Vayikra lo Elokei Yisrael. He called him, or he called it Elokei Yisrael. El Elokei Yisrael. Lo sham yisbeach karui Elokei Yisrael. Not that he called the altar, right? Elokei Yisrael. That's not what happened. El al shem shahaya kadosh baruch hu imo behitzilo kara shem hamizbeach al shem hanes. Okay? So it just happens to be that because Hashem was with him and Hashem saved him, so he called the name of the Mizbeach, you know, he associated the altar with the miracles that happened there. To say that the praise of Hashem should be associated with the name of that place. Kolomar, as if to say, Mishahu El, Hu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is the God? That's the God of the universe. Hu Elokim, he's the right. Hu Elokim Li, he is my God. Shishmi Yisrael, right, and my name is Yisrael. El Elokei Yisrael, he's the God and he's my God, etc. Jump for a moment to the next line. Four words from the end of the line. V'rabuseinu darshuhu shakadosh baruch hu karu liyakov el. What happens now? Now Rashi quotes the Medrash, which says that, how do you read the pasuk? Hashem called Yaakov el. Wow, I don't even know what that means. Midrashically, homiletically, right, it wasn't just that there was a one-way relationship between Yaakov singing out the praise of Hashem. Hashem actually sings out the praises of Yaakov and calls Yaakov El, which might mean Mighty One, something to that effect. So what happened in this Rashi? Which interpretation does Rashi think is right?
I don't think the one where he says he calls him El.
Why do you think? Meaning, the two interpretations: either he called out the name of Hashem, or Hashem called out Yaakov's name and called him out. Right? Which is the pshat? Which is the drash?
Hashem called
don't think he'll call the reached state in order to be called El, you know.
That's why it's Midrash, right? That's why it's Midrash. Avi?
From the way he phrases it, he says, well, Rabbi, yes. It's almost as if, you know, I don't agree with them, but I want you to know what they say about it.
Okay. So that's meaning the first four lines in the bulk of his interpretation is really, right, what seems to be the interpretation that he's furthering, the interpretation that he thinks is right, and that's what he would call pshat. If you pinned him down and you said, hey, Rashi, what's pshat in the pasuk? He would say, oh, Hashem, you know, Yaakov called out the name of Hashem in this particular place as a praise to Hashem. And then if you said, hey, Rashi, what's the medrash? Oh, you know, the medrash is that Hashem actually called Yaakov El. What's amazing is the next line in Rashi. He concludes with the underline. He says, and I want to tell you something. The Divrei Torah, now he quotes from the 23rd chapter of Yirmiyah. The Divrei Torah kepatish yifotze tsela. What does that mean? The words of Torah are like a hammer on an anvil splitting the rock. What does he say? Nischalkim lekama ta'amim. The words of Torah can be divided, can be split, can be given to a multiplicity of interpretations. Vani liyashev pshuto v'shomo shel mikra bati. And this, I think, is really the most telling programmatic statement of the three that we've seen here tonight. What's my goal, Rashi says? What's my mission? I come, liyashev pshuto v'shomo shel mikra. Like to give you a sense of the meaning of the text. To give you a sense or the essence of the meaning of the text. And I think what Rashi is really telling you is it could be both. Sometimes it'll be pshat, sometimes it'll be drash, and sometimes it'll be both. My goal is to give you a sense of what the text is really trying to communicate. Sometimes I can do that best by telling you the Midrash explanations, as in Shir Hashirim. Sometimes I can do it best by resorting to the pshat and just giving you the straight grammar, making things fit. And sometimes I'll give you both, because one of the interpretations is lacking, something is missing, and perhaps the two interpretations complement each other and provide some greater sense of what the text is really trying to tell us. Now,
couldn't this be another example of Rashi wanting to get away from the idea that a man is called God, and it's a Christological argument that they would be using against the Jews, and that's why he says that a hammer will break the rocks? In other words, that these explanations aren't exactly in the text. They're after you break the text into pieces that you can draw out this kind of...
That's very nice. I hadn't thought of it that way. I think that's a nice image. And I think the real key here is that one of the revolutions of Rashi's commentary on the Torah is that he's not wed to a particular direction of interpretation. You know, in contemporary literature, let's say, so very often you'll have someone who will profess a particular viewpoint. And they'll believe it so much that they think that it's true to the exclusion of all other viewpoints. This is the meaning, this is the emet. And what's so fascinating about Rashi is that he's a little unwilling to do that. You know, this could be right, that could be right, one of them is better than the other, sometimes this, sometimes that, sometimes both. And there can be a kind of pluralism, which is amazing to think that in the 11th century, someone could be thinking in those terms.
He said previously that pshuto shel mikra is what he wanted.
Right.
Here he adds pshuto.
Yeah.
It's more than pshuto.
Right.
And whether he's equating the two, I'm not sure.
Right. And that's why I like this formulation much better, that it's really something more than just pshat. I mean, it's not pshat for pshat sense. It's pshat when that'll help convey the real essence of the text, and it's drash when that'll help better convey the real essence of the text. hearing.
Could it be in any way that he wants to kind of, he's doing something new here in coming up with his personal interpretations because he's just bringing that tradition. He wants to be accepted by the rabbis and show respect for the tradition and maybe
you're saying as a kind of apologetic, that really he believes in pshat, but he feels the need to cite the rabbis.
Yeah, I'm not sure why he thinks his medrash where Yaakov is called God. It doesn't seem to go with the rest of how he thinks, unless, and he brought it in order to show you this conclusion, which is there are many ways to look at the text. In our generation, we have a more, let's say, a more rational way of looking at things. We need to understand how the words flow. But, you know,
the
so
respect that they're abundant. Right. No, I think that is a great point. And it's actually a good segue into the next source that I want to look at. We'll start it tonight and we'll continue it next time. What I want to turn to now is really the question of how Rashi works.
Does anybody think that they're not giving the true meaning of the text? I mean, isn't that everybody's...
Well, for instance, all I mean to say is that very often you'll have someone who will come along and say the true meaning of the text is, and the other explanation is wrong. And more often than not, what Rashi is saying is the explanation I like the best is this, and there's also another explanation. Not that A is right and B is wrong, as many other commentaries would suggest, but A is preferred, or I give a lot of credence to A, and I'm telling you B. I'm spending my time and my energy and my ink to produce a commentary which tells you B, which, you know, he didn't have to write Rav Hussein Darshu. He could end it, meaning he told you a perfectly legitimate way to read the pasuk. Just end right there. What does he need to continue for? But Rashi really believes that there's a second level, and that sometimes either the two will complement each other, or that sometimes the two are equally good, or the second approach is an alternative to the first.
But that just shows that he's open-minded. It doesn't show that his program is any different than anybody else's. You try to get them with the Peshuto and Mashmaot, but
right. No, I don't mean to conflate the points. Meaning, it's two separate points. And thank you for calling me on that. Meaning, one point is to say, and this is the sort of sidebar, which is just to point out the revolutionary nature of Rashi's ability to be kind of open-minded and pluralistic. The real point that I want to express is that unlike Rashbam, for instance, who's totally, you know, wed exclusively almost to a pshat kind of approach and would reject Medrash almost out of hand, Rashi is unwilling to do that on either side of the coin. He's not willing to reject Medrash just because it's Medrash. He's not willing to reject pshat just because it's pshat, but he's willing to incorporate both for the sake of getting to the essence of what the Torah really means. So I hope that helps clarify a little. Okay. Esther, do you want to jump in? Okay. So let me just raise one point, and then we'll close because we don't have enough time to really open this up fully. Okay, if you have a look at source number 7, page 2, source number 7. So this is the end of Parshas Bo and the beginning of Parshas Vayera. Okay. Moshe has just made his first venture to the kingdom of Paro. Things haven't gone too well. After his first visit, Paro basically increases the burdens on the Jewish people. Moshe is frustrated. Okay, so what happens? Vayeshev Moshe el Hashem, vayomer Hashem, lama hariyosa. I'm sorry, vayomer Adoni, lama hariyosa, lama zeh shelachtani. Moshe says, you know, why did you do this, Hashem? You've made things worse. Why did you even send me? Umiyaz bati al paro leads with a very bishmecha, hara'a la mazev, atzel lo atzel te asamecha. No salvation came of this. Things only got worse as a result of my goal. Okay? That's how Parshas Bo ends, and now Parshas Vayera begins. But in verse 1, in source number 7, the third line. Vayomer Hashem Omecha. Ha! Tzireh Asher Aseh, I'm sorry, this is actually the last lines of Bo. Vayomer Hashem Omecha. Ha! Tzireh Asher Aseh Lefaro Kiv Yad Chasakai Yishalcham, Yad Chasakai Yigrashem Yaitzel. actually, Hashem says, don't worry about it, you're going to see, I'm going to do great things to save the Jewish people and remove them from Paro's land. Then Hashem says, I am Hashem, I am Yud Kei Vav Kei, using the four-letter name of God. Ve'erel Abraham El Yitzchak Ve'el Yaakov Bekel Shagai Yishmi Hashem L'Nadak Yohem. I appeared to your forefathers Abraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov Bekel Shakai, but I never made known my essence as the four-letter name of Hashem. So far so good? Just want to focus on one pasuk, and with this we'll close. Pagam hakimosi es brisi tam laseis lahem es eretz kanan es eretz migurim asher garuba. Okay, what's the meaning of verse number 4? Pagam hakimosi es brisi tam.
And I fulfilled, I fulfilled my covenant with them.
I established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their inheritance, in which they will dwell. Now, let me just ask you.
But if something is strange, yeah. It always bothers me as an Israeli. Well, there were already nations who established their land there and so forth. How in the heavens do you go and take away? Do you understand my point?
I'm sorry, actually, that you weren't here for I don't remember if it was our second or third class, but we actually saw Rashi who addressed that point.
But Eretz Plishtim is the original name of the land. Right. The Plishtim were...
Or Canaan, yeah. The Canaan, Vakneni Azbaris. Right.
The Canaan.
Right.
Ha Plishtim Gaush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll reserve that, because we actually did address that point. I think it's an excellent question. I want to come back to it.
Yeah.
But my only question is, how much of what God is saying is coming as a response to Moshe's criticism, Moshe's complaint, and how much of what God is saying is actually an introduction to everything that's about to come? Which is to say, is this God and Moshe in conversation, or is this God speaking in a vacuum? Now, we'll investigate this more next time, and that question will hopefully make more sense as we look at Rashi's commentaries. But what I want to really unlock next time is the mystery of how Rashi produced his commentary. And he had this whole world of Midrashic literature at his disposal, and I really want to look at two questions. One is the question somebody raised tonight: what are the questions that bother Rashi? Meaning, he's not responding to theological questions. We look at Kedas Yitzchak in the whole commentary of Rashi. Rashi never says, how could God do that to a person? And that wasn't Rashi's agenda. So what I want to look at are the mechanics of Rashi. Question number one: how does Rashi operate, in the sense of what are the questions that really Rashi is attempting to answer? And then once we answer that question, what I really want to know is, how does Rashi go about answering that? And again, as we said, Rashi's not inventing new commentary. He's taking excerpts and extracting from existing commentaries, and the question is, how do you decide? Right, you have this whole corpus of Midrashic literature at your disposal. When are you going to take a Midrash? When are you going to give a Pshat? And when are you going to know how to choose? How are you going to know how to choose between all the Midrashim at your disposal? So the project for next week is really, if you were Rashi, what's the commentary that you would write? So we'll pick up with this question next week at 7 o'clock. Of course, everyone is invited to stay for Rabbi Strafler's class, Moses, Muhammad, and Me, which will begin in just a moment.